every year.
Welcome, everyone. Can y'all hear me in the back? Loud and clear in the back. Welcome to Dallas Philosophers Forum. We're thrilled to see everybody out here tonight. We're dedicated to bringing philosophy, ideas, and intellectual discussion to an interested audience in the DFW Metroplex. I'm Rob Olson. I appreciate everyone coming out tonight. We meet the second and fourth Tuesday of the month from September through May. So anyway, we have a few first-time visitors. One lady back here, you're a first-time visitor. You heard about us through your friend, and she heard about us through UNT. You are a philosophy major at UNT. And any other first-time visitors? Okay, yes, have y'all heard about us?
Meetup.
Okay, very good. And you, sir? Meetup as well? Okay, fantastic. We're excited that you're here. Anybody else, first-time visitors? Okay, how about you?
I will say, I've been on and off visitor since 1994.
Okay.
My wife has come for the first time.
Oh, welcome.
Okay. Well, I'm going to learn to be happy.
Ah, okay. Very good. Well, you came to the right place. Anyone else? First-time visitors?
Ditto.
Okay. Ditto as well. Okay. All right. Great. We're really glad to have everybody out tonight. If you haven't paid already, if you can do so right after the meeting, our esteemed treasurer, it's David Alkeck, it's $5 or $2 if you're a student. And if you want to become a subscriber, it's $35 for 6 months worth of lectures, so it's a heck of a deal. And I also want to remind everyone to pay their meal and for their drinks afterwards. Every once in a while, someone will inadvertently forget to pay. And we're a not-for-profit organization, so then we have to eat that charge. And so I'm sure they didn't do it intentionally, but just make sure that you take care of that before you leave. We appreciate it. We're working on our spring schedule, and let me just tell you a few things we have coming up. You can tell your friends and family members. We have Justin Fisher with SMU speaking on, do we have a prudential reason to believe in God? Skip Kilmer, one of our longtime members, he's going to be speaking on supermodels, our quest to explain the nature of reality and the reality of nature. And that's going to be quite intriguing. You have anything to say about that, Skip?
I'm sure that one will stay.
Yeah. I'm sure you will. We're going to have the poet laureate of Oklahoma. I didn't know they had poetry in Oklahoma. But we're going to have the poet. We got to have the poet laureate from Oklahoma, not Dr. Nathan Brown. He's going to be speaking on the power of brevity, the role of poetry in a world of too many words. So I think that's going to be really intriguing. Yeah. We have Robert Hunt with the Perkins School of Theology, SMU School of Theology, on religion and political consciousness in a post-secular age. So we have a gentleman from Dallas Baptist University tonight. We're thrilled to have him. And we've got Robert Hunt from SMU. So we're going to be covering various angles on religious issues, religion and philosophy. And then we've got a professor from Austin College who's speaking on Montesquieu as a conservative liberal. So we've got a couple more to line up, but we're making good progress. And we're going to get this out to everyone as soon as possible. In addition, we have a website that has a lot of the same information. You can sign up for our email list on that website and forward that link on to family and friends. It's www.philosophersforum.org.
No, just Philosophers Forum.
Oh, is it just the Philosophers Forum? I should know that. Philosophersforum.org. We've only been in this organization for 6 or 7 years, so I don't even know our website. And then you can get updates on meetings at www.meetup.com. That is Dallas Philosophers Forum. /members. And if anyone's interested in doing some volunteer work to help us out, we have some needs in AV and social media. We're a bunch of old guys that don't know much about social media. And so we could use some help from some of you young whippersnappers out there. So if anybody's interested in helping, that would be awesome. So tonight our speaker will present for about 45 minutes and then open up to questions. People that come here always have lots of questions. That's one of the great things about this group. And then last thing, before I introduce our speaker, please turn off your cell phones or put them on on a vibrate mode at this time. And now I'd like to introduce our speaker. We're very privileged to have Dr. David Noggle with us tonight. Dr. Noggle is chair and professor of philosophy, been there 25 years, right? Coming up on almost 25 years at Dallas Baptist University, where he has worked in both administrative and academic capacities. He has not one, but two doctorates. He earned his PhD in systematic theology from Dallas Theological Seminary, and a PhD in humanities with a concentration in philosophy and English literature. It's an interesting combination, from UTA. And so you did your dissertation on metaphysics, is that right, Dr. Noggle? Metaphysics?
And probably terms
worldview. And what?
Worldview.
And worldview, exactly, okay. He's published three books, many articles, and he's written three screenplays. So you'll have to ask him in the Q&A, you're going to have to ask him about his screenplays. This is pretty interesting. And a poet as well, right?
I'm not a poet.
Okay.
Maybe an inspiring one.
So he's going to be speaking. The thing that most attracted me, is my favorite singer of all time is Bob Dylan. And Bob Dylan is in his synopsis. So I hope he spent a lot of time talking about Bob Dylan and C.S. Lewis. And so I'm really looking forward to it. Now please join me in welcoming Dr. David Noggle.
I've got to turn on my microphone.
It's green.
Is it? Not,
it's the other one. Oh, wait a minute. It shows green before.
Oh. That should do it. Yeah, here we go. Okay. Yay! Okay, here's a limerick for you. I said I wasn't a poet, and I'm really not a poet. Although I have had one poem published.
Well, then you are.
Not really. But there once was a man named Guesser, whose knowledge grew lesser and lesser. It grew so small, he knew nothing at all, and now he's a college professor. Exactly. That's about the only poem that I know from memory. And that's in the form of a limerick. I don't know if I'm going to help you become a happy person tonight in the next 45 minutes. That's a tall order. But I'll do my best. And I am going to talk a little bit about Bob Dylan and his interview about happiness in Rolling Stone magazine. So that's coming up. I've got to wear these are readers. They're cheap ones. They came from Sam's. I'm going to begin this talk tonight with the assumption of a broken heart. If my assumption should happen to be premature in your case, and that is unlikely, then it's just a matter of time before the inevitable occurs. The world fractures everyone's heart sometime, somehow, some way, to one degree or another. No one is exempt. In the midst of our difficult circumstances, we feel the weight of our woes, and we long for some semblance of happiness or the happy life once again. Hope springs eternal in the human breast, said Alexander Pope in his essay on man. A lot, when you're talking about happiness in this discussion, depends on definitions. And so as the Syntopicon of the Great Books of the Western World, in Volume 2, Great Books of the Western World, we were talking about those earlier, says the great questions about happiness are concerned with its definition and with its attainability. So are we talking about a fluffy, paltry kind of happiness that our culture imparts to us? Maybe happiness is a yuppie word. Guess who said that? Bob Dylan.
It's a what word?
Guppy. Yuppie.
Guppy.
Yuppie. Yuppie. Not guppy. Yuppie.
Guppy world.
Don't sign up to help them with social media.
Thank you.
He was being interviewed by Rolling Stone magazine on the occasion of his 50th birthday, and the questioner, the interviewer, asked Bob Dylan in an unexpected way, "Bob, are you a happy man?" And he said, "Happiness, unhappiness, those are yuppie terms." And so he was talking about the fluffy, paltry definition of happiness. But maybe there is a deeper meaning, a robust meaning of happiness. In his Michael McKean Ethics, I think we're going to close the door there. No. Shut up that noise. In his Michael McKean Ethics, Aristotle said that happiness, and his Greek word for happiness was? Yeah, good spirit. Having a good spirit. He said that whatever it is, whatever happiness is, or whatever happiness was, he said it was the end of all action. It was desirable for its own sake. This is my third time, by the way, at the Dallas Philosophers Forum, and when I was here last time, I spoke with somebody who was a follower of Ayn Rand, the philosopher Ayn Rand. I guess he's not here. But in any case, I threw in a little Ayn Rand for his sake, in case he was here tonight. But Ayn Rand said that her only intellectual indebtedness was to Aristotle. Now, that's probably not true, but that's what she said nonetheless in an interview. And here's what Ayn Rand said about happiness. She said it is the moral purpose of man's life. That's what Ayn Rand said, the moral purpose of a human's life. Contemporary philosopher Charles, it looks like Taliaferro, but I think it's pronounced Tolliver, he asked these questions. How do you define happiness? What are the best ways to get there? Who is happy? Who is happier? Who is happiest? What doesn't lead to happiness? And in parentheses, he asks that we mistakenly think will lead to happiness. Has the definition of happiness changed significantly in the last few decades? And as Fyodor Dostoevsky and the Brothers Cave once inquired, he said this, "And yet, happiness, where is it? Who can say of himself that he is happy?" That's Dostoevsky and Brothers Cave. Needless to say, but I'm going to say it anyway, even though it's needless. Boom, boom. It's complicated. Happiness is complicated. And some are skeptical, like the character Max Sledge, played by Robert Duvall in the 1983 film Tender Mercies. Here's what Robert Duvall or Max Sledge in the film said. "I don't trust happiness. I never did. I never will." But what did Max Sledge or Robert Duvall, what did he mean by the use of the word happiness? Now, if you've been to the Nasher Sculpture Center, perhaps in the downtown Dallas Arts District, perhaps you've seen the sculpture of a woman, a beautiful bronze statue, actually, sculpture statue of a woman. I took a picture of it. And she seems to embody the inevitable condition of brokenness and pain. The work is by a noted French sculptor. His name is Aristide Milhaud. And the sculpture is provocatively titled Night, La Nuit. You can see it for yourself online. There's a picture of it online as well. So I've asked myself, and this is what she looks like. The female figure is folded in upon herself in an upright fetal position with her feet together, her knees pulled up tightly towards her chest. Her bowed head is buried in her crossed arms as they rest atop her knees in an apparent state of weariness and introspection. So I ask these questions. What is she thinking about? And what is she feeling as she sits in the dark, all alone? Has she simply endured a difficult day? Is she mentally and physically exhausted? Maybe the ordinary challenges of life have just caught up with her, and she is in a focused state of self-examination of prayer. Perhaps she is muttering to herself, "I'm a little weary of my life. I'm a little weary of weariness and strife." And that's actually a wintry statement that comes from George MacDonald. whatever the causes of this woman's dark night of soul, we can be pretty sure that her overall happiness or sense of well-being is at stake and under negotiation. This woman's crestfallen condition is not uncommon. If we slow down long enough in the midst of our busy lives, who among us hasn't occasionally inquired about our own happiness quotient? Especially in our quieter, more mellow moments late at night. We can all readily identify with these circumstances at different times and different places in our own lives. We too can feel very emotionally fragile. I bet you have, I have. We can feel physically depleted. We can think that our own troubles are as great as the sea or as a galaxy. If happiness is the theme of this woman's nocturnal ruminations, logomy night, then maybe she's asking questions as we might also ask them. Who am I, after all, and what is it that I have become? How did my life wind up the way that it has? Will it ever change? Whatever happened to my childhood or my adulthood dreams for a happy life? Why is happiness so important and yet so elusive? How are people supposed to be happy? Rob, she needs your 15 keys. How am I supposed to be happy? What is happiness anyway? Who or what can help me? The woman who is represented in the Milo sculpture or statue, should she come to life, could probably empathize with Leo Tolstoy's conflicted character, Anna Karenina, who on one occasion said this. She says, "I am simply unhappy. If anyone is unhappy, I am." Our lives are often miserable, and we think, is there any sorrow like my sorrow? Is there any pain like my pain? Maybe those in ancient days who observed birthdays with tears, and yet they celebrated funerals with joy, maybe they knew what they were doing. Maybe they were onto something. Given the injustices and sufferings that seemed to rule in the world, perhaps those who believed it was best to expire quickly, or even better, to have never been born at all, showed remarkably good judgment. How unfortunate we were to be born. How lucky should we be if we die soon? Ecclesiastes chapter 4, verses 1 through 3 would seem to say as much. He says, "Then I looked again," this is the author of Ecclesiastes chapter 4, verses 1 through 3, "Then I looked again at all the acts of oppression which were being done under the sun, and behold, I saw the tears of the oppressed, and that they had no one to comfort them. On the side of the oppressors was power, but they had no one to comfort them. So I congratulated the dead who are already dead more than the living who are still living. But better off than both of them is the one who has never existed, who has never seen the evil activity that is done under the sun." End of quote. Bereft of any hope, what else really remains but a cheerless and wretched existence? Still, we are resilient. Don't forget Alexander Pope in his essay on man. Despite the odds, the hope for a better, even a genuinely happy life persists, whatever we might think it is. It endures for most of us. Now, in a philosophy book that I use in an introduction to philosophy class at my school has this quote, and I'm going to read it to you. It's, first of all, anonymous. Maybe somebody knows who said this. "Life is a bowl of cherries." But then Rodney Dangerfield came along and said, after that, life is the pits. You've got no respect for that. Intense interest in happiness, especially our own, is a constant in human history. And it's a constant in human history because it is a constant of human nature. As persons who are comprised of body and soul, we earnestly desire and seek whatever we think it takes to fulfill these combined aspects of our nature. We all aspire to some sort of felicity, both mentally and physically, whether we are willing to admit it or not. Each of us is jealous and zealous for our personal well-being as whole persons. Let me explain these parts of us scream for attention and demand a satisfying response. This much is the unalterable human condition. And I'm going to quote a poet here. It's not Bob Dylan, though. Sorry about that. Contemporary poet David Hopes says as much. We are of one ambition and one lineage. Want, not in proportion to any need, but want, unreasonable and overflowing. Our days and nights are overshadowed with desire. So if we pay attention to our own lives and observe carefully the lives of other people, we will soon discern that a desire for happiness of one kind or another is the conscious, the subconscious, or the unconscious motivation for just about everything that we do. Most of our daily lives and activities are aimed at the goal of experiencing and enhancing some measure of well-being and delight, even if such intentions are in the unacknowledged backgrounds of our minds. What besides our own welfare could possibly lie silently behind our feverish educational, vocational, or economic pursuits? Why else would we seek knowledge, career success, or basic material provision if our own good wasn't somehow or another at stake? What other than a sense of fulfillment motivates us in our family relationships, our friendships, and our recreations, and attending a session of the Dallas Philosophers Forum? Food and drink, clothing and shelter, while necessary for survival, are also things that we seek to enjoy. Our quest applies to all things. Why do I do what I do? Why do you do what you do? Here's the answer. We want to be happy, both now and ever after. Here's what Karl Barth had to say about that. His name is pronounced Bart, but it sounds like Black Bart. But it's spelled B-A-R-T-H. In every real person, the will for life is also the will for joy. It is hypocrisy, Bart says, to hide this from one's self. Perhaps this is why we tend to think that real gusto is just the next relationship, the next purchase, or the next achievement away. Like Bart, just about all the great religions, philosophies, and thinkers were eudaimonistic. Religions, philosophies, or thinkers. Past to present, they have confirmed what our intuitions and experiences in life indicate about the universality of the quest for delight in life. And though their teachings and methods differ, Islam, Buddhism, Taoism, and Hinduism all acknowledge some form of personal well-being and the well-being of others to be at the forefront of their respective religious traditions, whether in this life or the next, or in both somehow. Plato, on one hand, believed that every desire we have is for good things or happiness, and that happiness is equated with the things that we love most dearly, and sometimes we love things recklessly. Aristotle, as I mentioned before, affirmed that happiness was the end of things pursued in action and was the product of moral and intellectual virtue, sustained, as Aristotle said, by a sufficient supply of external goods or goods of fortune, such as food, clothing, shelter, work, friends, and Aristotle said this actually in the Nicomachean Ethics, not being born ugly. Which I think is kind of interesting. Both philosophers, Plato and Aristotle, recognized that happiness as the end of a well-ordered was the end of a well-ordered life through reason and virtue. And if you are Aristotle as well, a sufficient supply of external goods or goods of fortune. St. Augustine said that it is this decided opinion of all who use their brains that all people desire to be happy. In the Middle Ages, Thomas Aquinas, who lived from 1225 to 1274, said that happiness was the ultimate end of human life, both naturally and supernaturally, culminating in a beatific vision. The French mathematician Blaise Pascal, 1623 through 1662, asserted, and I quote him here from his Pensée, that all people are in search of happiness. There is no exception to this, whatever different methods are employed. When Sigmund Freud was asked, what about the behavior of people reveals about the purpose of their lives? This is what Freud said. He said, quote, They strive after happiness. They want to become happy and remain so. C.S. Lewis, in a letter, maintained that it is a duty for everyone to be as happy as he can. And finally, we should note also that this longing for happiness is not just an individual matter. As Barbara Ehrenreich has shown in her book, Dancing in the Streets, from ancient Bacchanalia feasts to present-day concerts and sporting events, there is an ingrained human instinct as basic as the quest for food and shelter, for there is a basic instinct for communal celebration, or as she calls it in the subtitle to her book, more collective joy. And though there is significant disagreement on what happiness is and how to get it, the definition and the attainability issues once again, there is substantial agreement in recognizing happiness as the bullseye on the target at which we aim our lives. As Aristotle said, people agreed that the highest of all goods pursued in life was happiness, but they disagreed about what happiness is, and the many do not give the same answer as the wise, or as the philosophers possibly. And certainly then, this hope for happiness is a non-negotiable ingredient that seems to be built into our very nature as human beings, regardless of the what, the where, and the how. The desire and the quest for happiness will remain with us as long as our race shall last. Now the pursuit of happiness, American style. The pursuit of happiness, again, is in the Declaration of Independence, isn't it?
Indeed it is.
While happiness is undoubtedly a universal human quest, its pursuit seems closely associated with the American experiment. The American experience. As Dan Savage has written in his book, Skipping Towards Gomorrah, The Seven Deadly Sins and the Pursuit of Happiness in America, these are his words, the truly revolutionary promise of our nation's founding document is the freedom to pursue happiness with a capital H. Whatever Mr. Jefferson and the other writers might have meant by the pursuit of happiness, this theme has effectively worked its way into the vocabulary, the consciousness, and the lifestyles of most Americans. A relatively recent 2006 survey of one of the most popular courses at Harvard University was on the psychology of happiness, taught by Daniel Gilbert and based on his book, Stumbling on Happiness. And this is what Random House said about that particular book. A book that describes what science has to tell us about how and how well the human brain can imagine its own future and about how and how well it can predict which of those futures it will most enjoy. The quest for the happy life seems to be one of the things that most Americans can't agree on. We probably do agree on it. Though serious divisions of religion, race, class, gender, and politics affect our society, the pursuit of happiness seems to be the social glue that makes the one out of the many. The pluribus unum. We are bound together by a gospel of psychological happiness, asserts Eva Moskowitz in her discussion of America's obsession with happiness and America's consummate trust in psychotherapy to get us there. Since the concept of happiness is so important socially in the United States, we might want to ask, how are Americans doing in this rather important category? In a 2013 University of Leicester study, they produced the world's happiness map. The USA came in number 23. Denmark, so I guess if you want to be happy, we'd put to Denmark, right? Denmark was number one. The three least happy countries according to the happiness map were the Democratic Republic of the Congo at number 176, Zimbabwe at number 177, and coming in at number 178 was Burundi, B-U-R-U-N-D-I. Furthermore, according to a 2005 Pew Research Center publication, about one-third of adults in the United States rank themselves as very happy, 34% actually. 50% of Americans say they're pretty happy, and about 15% have the doldrums. 1% said, I'm not really sure, one way or the other, I don't know. Be this as it may, given our freedom to and our substantial success in achieving the American dream of happiness, Many people around the world strive to join us in our felicity experience and experiment. The freedom to pursue happiness having been vouchsafed to us by political promises. For example, one Chinese graduate student that I met gave herself the English name Sharon, and her email address was SharonTheAmericanDream@something.com. So given this fixation on felicity, happiness gurus abound to tell us how this ever-present longing can be suitably satisfied. I think it's impossible to keep up with the flood of books, seminars, and websites and magazines that are devoted to helping us find our bliss. But one example, here's one book. Martin Seligman's 2012 work called Flourish, A Visionary New Understanding of Happiness and Well-Being. Also, there is the popular periodical Psychology Today that provides updates on the state of the science or the art of this on a regular basis. Some of the advice on offer smacks of common sense and is somewhat helpful. A lot of it, on the other hand, is plain silly and is simply and ultimately jejune or empty. Regardless, the happiness business seems to be flourishing. Needless to say, but I'm going to say it anyway, it's hard to talk about happiness in a meaningful way without sounding like a child, or a cynic, or more likely, a purveyor of tired and shallow truisms. Wilfred McClay remarks, "The problem is that while happiness is a subject of central importance to our human existence and a matter of irrepressibly consuming interest, many of the most reliable truths about it may come across disappointingly flat and trite and commonplace. Surely we think to ourselves, this elusive thing that we pant after can have been captured by a sugary Hallmark greeting card or the maudlin lyrics of a country western song. One of the main problems, as I said earlier, is coming up with a suitable definition of the term. And in surveying the chaos surrounding the notion of his day, the ancient Roman philosopher Seneca, who lived approximately 5 B.C. to A.D. 65, wrote these relevant words. He said this, "There is not anything in this world, perhaps, that is more talked of and less understood than the business of a happy life. It is every person's wish and design, and yet not one in a thousand knows wherein that happiness consists. We live, however, in a blind and eager pursuit of it, and the more haste we make in the wrong direction, the further we are from our journey's end." That was Seneca's observations, though, it seems to me, ring true today. In the midst of our chitter-chatter, and that's what we do a lot of, that is chitter-chatter, and despite our ignorance, we hurry off energetically and yet indiscriminately in pursuit of our individualized Shangri-La. What we do know, however, is that many forces, scientific, economic, cultural, and so on, have produced a paradigm shift in the way most people understand happiness. It has morphed in many people's minds of USA citizens into virtual promise of sustained pleasure and painlessness. No pain, no pain. Think about that. More than a few conceive of the concept of happiness in sensualistic, materialistic, and egotistical terms. Food and sex, wealth and possessions, achievement and power, are the goals that goad so many of us into action to fulfill our lives. We are in search of an everlasting ideal in education, finances, work, technology, marriage, friendship, travel, adventure, health, entertainment, recreation, religion, food, drink, sex, self, and in life itself. In brief, this noble concept of happiness has been trivialized as we've moved from concern with metaphysical being and doing a fixation now on feeling good. Philip Reif called it the triumph of the therapeutic, and I quote him here, that a sense of well-being has become the end rather than a byproduct of striving after some superior communal end. It announces, our current quest does, announces a fundamental change in focus in the entire cast of our culture. Chris Smith, a sociologist at the University of Notre Dame, along with Melinda Lundquist calls it moralistic therapeutic deism. That is, be good, that's the moralistic part. Be happy, that's the therapeutic part. And God is your cosmic butler, that's the deistic part. Consequently, the notion of happiness drained of its deeper meaning has caused many to call it into question. Don't worry, be happy. Sang Bobby McFerrin. Those who study the history of the idea of happiness in a Western context have observed how it migrated from its original home in religion and philosophy to the political sphere, and most recently into the domain of individualized experience, especially in North America. Classically, among the great Western philosophers and theologians, happiness denoted the state of the genuine fulfillment of human nature that resulted from being properly related as a person to the truth about reality, or metaphysics. Educating the soul to conform it to reality, rather than conforming reality to the dictates of the individual soul, was the secret to the happy life. But those days of defining happiness and the good life, whatever it means to be truly human, are long gone. When serious doubts arose about knowing the truth about human nature and reality, and especially in the postmodern period, the government became the guarantor of freedom for people to pursue happiness as they saw fit. In some cases, the government took upon itself to be a partial provision and source of its provision, happiness is provision, at least in a material way. As we have seen in the U.S. has led the way in this regard, the Revolutionary War being fought in part to provide freedom for felicity's sake. Happiness has fallen within the jurisdiction, in other words, of politics. Nowadays, happiness is still protected by cherished political ideals and institutions. However, under the massive influence of a capitalistic and technological society centered in a sovereign self, the term has been thoroughly subjectivized and relativized. Happiness is a person-relative concept, often associated with individual choice, agreeable circumstances, and pleasure-giving experiences. Happiness is often, as I said before, focused on the trivial and the ephemeral. It caters to feelings and to the word, in the worst sense of the word, of the flesh. Even if the basic pattern of life, a basic pattern of life, is punctuated by an occasional generous or selfless act. Here's what John Lennon and Paul McCartney of the Beatles once sang in the song called Because. Because the sky is blue, it makes me cry. The noted German term Sehnsucht, Sehnsucht, is used to describe this obstinate aspiration for something that satisfies, even though we seem perpetually estranged from it. Amidst the storms and stresses of daily life, this inconsolable longing, for we know not what, gets triggered unexpectedly and stabs us in mind and in heart in most unexpected ways and times, like when you're pushing a cart down the aisle of a grocery store, for example. Either Sehnsucht is elicited by a blue sky, as Lennon and McCartney once sung, or a beautiful face, or the melancholy of a requiem, the lure of a romance, the crashing waves of the sea, a mountain range, perhaps a seascape, the scintillations of sex, the profundity of a film, an illuminating line of poetry, a beautiful song, or an unobstructed view of the Milky Way, we occasionally experience a mysterious and tremendous feeling that attracts and baffles us simultaneously. We need it, whatever, and want it, whatever it is. We are convinced it is what we have been looking for and searching for all our lives. Lewis, as in C.S., called it joy. And he made joy the central story of his life. The late Dallas Morning News paper editorial writer, Paul Kroon, experienced this feeling unexpectedly on at least two occasions, and he presented both of them in an essay that appeared on Christmas Day in 1967 in the editorial section of the Dallas Morning News. It's an editorial that has appeared on Christmas Day by the same author every year since 1967. And here's what he wrote. He says, I remember a time when in my final days in college, when the chinaberry trees were abloom and the air was sweet with spring blossoms, and I stood still on the street, suddenly struck with
I was suddenly struck with the feeling of something that was an enormous promise and yet was no tangible promise at all. And there was another night in a small boat when the moon was full and the distant headlands were dark, but beautiful, and we were lonely. The pull of a nameless emotion was so strong that it filled the atmosphere. The small boy within me cried. Most of us have had experiences like Mr. Prunes, sometime, somewhere along the way. How, when, and where has it ever happened to you? How, when, and where has it happened to me? We tend to confuse the medium of the experience for what it communicates. We idolize the people, the places, and the things that point us to their greater divine cause, failing to realize that they are just signals of transcendence, of what satisfies ultimately. Thus we have enormous problems because of our profound ignorance, our disordered loves, and lack of faith. We have been frustrated. We are guilty of a severe reductionism, one of the chief sins of our century. Because of our profound ignorance, disordered love, and lack of faith, we have been frustrated. Our persistent efforts to discover the happy life and our fulfillment of that inconsolable longing continues right up to the present moment. As one bumper sticker puts it, we are in search of the eternal buzz. But we have broken and restless hearts. That's the assumption with which I began this talk. Until I rest you. And that's the assumption with which I will conclude. Thank you very much.
I think we have quite a few minutes for questions. I ask that you keep your statement fairly short and get to your question.
Nice to see you again. It's been 20, 30 years since we've talked. I have a different view,
okay,
that I wanted to bring up.
All right.
And see what you thought of it. And that is, happiness is not a state of being or a state of having anything, but rather an attitude. So that I would argue in my own philosophy that if you want to be happy, choose to be happy. That's all you have to do, and you will be happy no matter what your circumstances are. Unless you're just so, you know, starving that you're dying or something like that. But
or you have terrible cancer or something like that.
You choose, my point is that you choose to be happy. Mm-hmm. You don't need anything to make you happy. It's a psychological thing. You choose it. Well, I was wondering how you would talk about it.
Well, your question, comment, reminds me of a book that I read a few years ago, so I don't remember a whole lot about it, but I must admit, I didn't like the book. Because it was called Happiness is a Choice. It was by a psychiatrist, and I felt like it embraced stoicism. And so there wasn't, as Aristotle said in the Nicomachean Ethics, any room in this particular book, or perhaps in your comment about the choice, as you said, though, at the very end, unless you're starving to death, unless there is a sufficient supply of external goods or goods of fortune, we need those, because we are material beings living in the material world. We're embodied beings. And so we have to have those things that satisfy us. So I think it includes a choice, it includes an attitude, for sure. There's no doubt about that. But I think there's more to it than just simply that. So I would say yes, partially.
Yes, but.
Yes, but.
Yes,
yeah.
I would agree.
Okay.
Question over here. Just a second, Mark.
Okay.
Did you have a question?
You mentioned Denmark.
Uh-huh. That's the happiest country.
Can you give us a brief summary of the culture and lifestyle of that country? Could you tell us a little bit?
I'm glad you asked me if I could, because I can't. I can, but I can't read surveys. And it didn't tell me anything about Denmark, per se.
Well, a friend of mine just got back from Denmark, and he said it was one of the most egalitarian countries in the world. That there was relatively very little wage or wealth inequality. And that's one of those.
Well, there you have it.
Okay.
I mean, that's in our founding document, the Declaration of Independence. All men are created equal. So, but
not everybody was equal.
I've thought about it a lot. Mm-hmm. And if you look at people who are happy, whether they win some money at a slot machine or they're getting the Nobel Prize or they're kissing it, the one thing that they all have in common is they feel good. And I'm convinced that's all it is. It's a matter of degree and how prolonged it is. I get a good job, I feel good over a long period of time, but it's mood, almost like how high am I? And really, is it anything more than that? It's what makes you feel good. It's that simple.
Well, I wouldn't want to deny that feeling good is a part of it, but I'm not sure that's the whole story. I think that, once again, you have to bear in mind the word reductionism. And we don't want to reduce, in my estimation, the concept of happiness from doing good or being good to feeling good. So I would say, while I would say that feeling good is probably a part of being a happy person because of certain circumstances, perhaps, but I don't think it's the whole story. That's the way I would look at it.
I want to ask you about Ecclesiastes, because you mentioned one of the more sorrowful chapters within it.
Right.
When I remember reading the entire Bible in my senior year, I also read some nihilists and some French existentialists in recent times of my high school. And it seemed to me that a lot of what Solomon was saying or whoever wrote Ecclesiastes was pretty similar in some ways to existentialism and in other ways similar to nihilism, but in other ways similar to the Greek ideal of moderation in all things. I mean, the portions where in the beginning, maybe I think it's the first and second chapter where he's saying, I tried to do all these palace buildings and this and that and the other, but it was all foolish chasing after the wind, I think is the way he puts it.
Yeah.
That seemed like the existentialist thing or even nihilism.
Yeah.
And then the next chapter, they call it chapter 3, he says there's a season for everything, a purpose and blah, blah, blah. And it's sort of like that you don't pursue one thing into its extreme, but you have a balanced life of the things that you pursue where they're all in the right time and place, which seemed to me more like the Greek ideal of moderation in all things. I was wondering how you would view all the chapters of Ecclesiastes in comparison with, both the Greek ideal, which is more like a contemporary and biblical philosophy, and then also with more modern philosophies.
This is how I understand Ecclesiastes. Ecclesiastes as a commentary on the bigger story of Scripture. There is creation, there is fall, and Ecclesiastes is a commentary on the fall. And there is redemption. There was an article that was in First Things magazine, I think it was in 1993, so it's been a while. But the title of the article was How the World Lost Its Story. And I think that's a pretty good title, actually. And I think that he was bargaining for recovery of the world's story. He was a Lutheran theologian who wrote this article. But I think there does need to be a recovery of that story, of the creation fall, which is where Ecclesiastes belongs, redemption story. How Ecclesiastes relates to modern philosophy, it seems to me a lot of modern philosophy is nihilistic, not exceptionally valuable, a lot of chitter-chatter. And so in some ways I would see the book of Ecclesiastes agreeing with its statement about vanity and futility. It could be put, philosophy in part, could be put in the list of things that didn't bring final meaning. I tell students at Dallas Baptist University that philosophy is not number one, but it's number two. I think that there is the science or the study of something that's greater than philosophy. And so, I guess this is the time to put your cards in the table. Sorry to know about the bid mark, but that's what I think about Ecclesiastes. And Ecclesiastes, it seems to me, on occasion, It also talks about what is good and proper. And I see that as a occasional commentary on Genesis 1 and 2. Where it says, I have, when the author of Ecclesiastes is probably Solomon, there is a debate on that. He was a preacher in Jerusalem. But he does say occasionally that he has seen this to be good and profitable. And that sounds like the goods of Genesis 1 and 2.
Question here.
Sure.
David, I guess Aristotle's eudaimonia, we translate as happiness, but it's also translated as flourishing or sense of well-being.
Right.
But all of those are, and not just joy, not just joyful, but still, it's a subjective feeling. It's a sensibility, sensitivity. It's a sensibility, I guess. So wherein does that lie? What does it consist of? If it's in the mind, then it's in the brain, then is it chemical for a moment? Is it, for example, an increase in serotonin? And if so, then can it be brought on by drugs? And apparently it can be, you know.
Prozac.
Yeah. Or cocaine or alcohol or whatever.
We some stimulant.
The opposite, depression, sadness, is chemical, hormonal. So my big reduction is, as you can see. So is it basically chemical?
Well, I would say that it is chemical in part. But I don't want to say it's all chemical. Just like I don't want to say it's all choice or all feeling. I think that there's more to being genuinely happy than just simply the chemical side of things. Although I don't discount that. And it took me getting married to find that out. And that's because my wife suffers from depression, and she takes mood-elevating drugs, and it has helped her. And so I will say that the biological, the chemical, whether it's Prozac or cocaine or alcohol or whatever it might possibly be, and by the way, your impressions of Baptists are not necessarily true. Just FYI. But I think that it's, I would not disagree with you. I just say that there's more to it than that.
I'd like to follow up on something I think I heard you said.
Okay.
You're talking about communal happiness.
Uh-huh.
Fairly well known result of winning the lottery is that it ruins your life. And there are a few exceptions. And these
there are even movies not about that.
Yeah. These exceptions suggested to some psychologists out in California, an experiment that they performed. They gave random students an amount of money, I don't know what it was, $25 or something like that, with one or two instructions. Mm-hmm. By 5 o'clock this afternoon, spend it on yourself to make you happy, or by 5 o'clock this afternoon, spend it on somebody else, and then come and report to us how you feel. And it should be pretty obvious to most of us what happened. The people that spent it on somebody else almost universally came back happier.
Mm-hmm.
The people that spent it on themselves probably just bought something they would have bought anyway. $25 is not going to change your life. But it didn't make them happier.
A white elephant gift at Christmas time.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's what we spent at least. $25 at Bed Bath & Beyond. Not a whole lot. So are you making a point or are you
asking a question? Have you heard
I don't know if I've heard of that specific...
From interacting with others.
Yes. I have heard something similar. I don't know if it's the exact same thing or not, but in talking with Rob before this meeting began, he said you can make a certain amount of money, but after you make a certain amount, it ceases to make you happy.
Mm-hmm. Then you go for the power.
Is that what it is?
Ultimate, the maximum happiness.
That's probably about right.
But then it's not money anymore. You're going after the power. That's why the rich keep going after more.
That's why Frank Capra did his films.
Another question here.
Yeah.
It seems to me that if you just take happiness by itself, it's somewhat of a disembodied entity. It needs to be attached to either an event, a condition, or a purpose. And it seems to me that purpose would be, play a very big part in it, because if someone is pursuing a purpose, they're willing to go through literal hell.
Mm-hmm.
But they'd still say they were happy because they're pursuing a meaningful purpose. So what's your take on that?
Well, there are lots, depends on definitions and that statement, I think, like purpose, what is the purpose, and so forth. But I would tend to agree that if you have proper purpose, and your mind is set on that proper purpose, then if you're heading for that purpose, that proper purpose, then all amount of evil can befall you, and you still seem joyful or happy. So I would say, to your question, yeah.
Okay. Yeah. So in your speech, you're talking about Seneca specifically, mm-hmm. and then in Bob's question, you said you couldn't get behind that but because of your stoicism. So I'm just kind of curious if you could elaborate on your position on stoicism and what would be your largest critique of the Stoics.
Well, stoicism, I think, especially in our century, is non-reactionary responses to events in life. We remain stoic. I don't think, I wrote a paper once, and this is a long time ago, but paper was the Aristotelian concept of happiness spot on, or the Stoic concept of happiness? And I felt like, and this was the ancient Stoics, and they said if you're a virtuous person, that's what the ancient Stoics said. The ancient Stoics said if you're a virtuous person, you'll be a happy person. I think there is a connection between virtue and happiness. I don't want to sever that tie by any stretch of the imagination. But I think that Aristotle was right in saying that, and this is what the Stoics did not say, that you need a sufficient supply of external goods or goods of fortune in order to be completely happy. And I'm into holes. Not partial, not something that's partial.
That's okay, it's kind of, it's lacking in the Stoic philosophy.
Yeah, correct.
You had,
I like Epicurus better than both of them.
I'm sorry?
I said I like Epicurus better.
Oh, okay. Well,
Dr. Nagel, you mentioned that philosophy was number two, and I inferred from that that religion was number one.
Correct.
And
theology.
Theology. And so I was wondering that...
And not just religion in general.
Right. So I'm just curious if you could just contrast in your mind philosophy from theology. Because I tend to think that they're both dealt with what's the meaning of life and what are the ultimate questions. And so I see those two in many ways tied close together.
But I think they are tied closely together. I'm not trying to be a politician here. What theology comments on, philosophy comments on. But as far as I can tell, theology would come before philosophy if you're going to put them in some kind of a pecking order.
And why is that?
Because the science of God, or the study of God, theology, theos, logos, is higher than just simply a love of wisdom. Why? Well, I'm going to pull an Anselm on you. God is that than which nothing greater can be conceived. And he's number one in my book.
If you start with that definition.
Yeah.
True.
Yeah.
Very good. Any other questions? Okay.
Here's my question.
So it is a choice.
Well, my question is, well, first of all, I agree with you, philosophy is number two, it's just that math is number one. But,
mathematics.
My question is about, you know, and I agree with you completely that you can't reduce happiness, or you try not to make it one simple thing, because what if the definition of happiness has to be part of the fact that it is, whether it's a feeling or an attitude, that it is that undefinable moment for you that you know you just are,
able to define it by this undefinable statement of what it is.
So, what's your question?
Well, that's my question. What, in a term of definition of happiness, where does that fall?
Well, I think it's, I would say yes to all of those things that you just mentioned, except mathematics. I can barely add up the bills that are in my wallet. So I would say that all those things are true, but you don't want to stop there. So that's where I'm coming from. I don't know if that is that satisfactory?
Yeah. I mean, as satisfactory as an undefinable thing can be, I guess.
Yeah. Well.
Or however.
What do you mean by undefinable?
I don't know. I mean, that's what I feel like happiness is so tricky. It's the second you put your hand on it, it's moved its place. You know, I don't know if it's, like, we can say, oh, in this case, this person was happy, but why were they happy? Once we get into the why of it, it changes. I don't know. Yeah, I feel like once you start trying to define it, it starts moving its definition of what it is. That's maybe why it can't be reduced to some simple little
formula. It's complicated. Yeah. Well, it's quite possible. I would say that it is, in a certain sense, incomprehensible or indefinable. But it can be known to some extent. Now, if you want to say system, that's fine. Or as a person, in a personal way.
Okay, let's get a round of applause to Dr. Monica.